Hey, it's the Deer Wizard, host of North American Deer Talk. I want to tell you about a great new advertising and research platform that we've developed for you, CWDbreeding.com. You know, as the deer industry continues to mature and develop around chronic wasting disease and its known genetic heritability, resources like CWDbreeding.com become essential tools for deer managers across the country making decisions about their herds. I really wanted a platform that excelled at hosting GBV and codon markers in a filterable and searchable manner, but I also wanted to have high quality pictures, videos, ages, scores, nadar numbers, and a whole host of other information to go along with that. This database puts everything in one easy to find location and allows you to access the industry's greatest genetic resources. I look forward to seeing all the great bucks that people have to offer in one easy to find location, CWDbreeding.com. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of North American Deer Talk. This is episode 104, EHD, the Med Gene Experience with Ashley Peterson. Ashley, how are you?
Good. How are you, Josh?
I am doing very well. Thanks for coming on today. I got a little bit of housekeeping to take care of, but I am excited to jump into this conversation. I am a novice, so I'm going to ask you to talk to me like I'm 5 years old in the understanding of what EHD is. We'll get into a whole range of other topics, so bear with me. If you're watching on YouTube, thank you so much. If you don't like YouTube and you prefer another platform, we do it over at Rumble as well. If you're listening on the podcast, we appreciate it. You can find us on all different podcasting platforms, Apple, Spotify, Amazon, Google, wherever you listen to podcasts, we are. And just a quick note, we did purchase all of the CNE wildlife inventory. We still have some fawn paste. Get your fawn paste before fawning season comes. We have a few hundred tubes left and that is gone forever. Okay, now that that's done, Ashley, I want to talk about EHD. I'm in Northern Pennsylvania. I've been raising deer for 25 years. I've never had EHD. I get lots of calls on EHD, probably not as many as you, but I get lots of calls. So I want to kind of work through this methodically, if you will. I want to start with the disease and get some background on that, so I have a better understanding of what this disease is, how it works on the body, and those kinds of things. So can you just give me a rundown of what is EHD?
So EHD is a hemorrhagic virus. It is in the same family as blue tongue. Something to note, they are two different viruses. And even within EHD or blue tongue, there are different serotypes. Three serotypes of EHD are in the US, and that's 1, 2, and 6. And 2 is by far the most prominent, kills the most deer every year. It is mostly just a concern for white-tailed deer as far as mortality events. There are other species that we've seen die from EHD infections. Usually it's really high prevalence years, or EHDV6 comes in when it hasn't been in the area, stuff like that. It's spread by a midge, so the little tiny gnats. And it really is more of a southern, kind of tropical, but each year it seems to be moving further and further north as we have a tempered climate now more than we ever have. So in Florida, Texas, those states, EHD can be seen year round, basically. There's still a seasonality to it, but I've seen cases come through from Florida in like January. So those states have to be kind of cognizant of it at all times, whereas other states, what we're typically going to see is cases start to come in about July. That's becoming more common, is seeing things start in July, but really the peak being August, September, and then kind of trickling out October, November. There have been times where it's been kind of a peak and it dies off and then another peak. We've seen that a couple years ago where there was a peak in like November, and it basically had to do with weather patterns where we saw like a heat wave in November, so.
I recall it's not super common here in Pennsylvania. We do have parts of our in the eastern part of our state and in the western part of our state. We don't see it too much because of the Appalachians kind of running up diagonal through our state. But when you look at the cases that they do find, they're usually kind of like it's kind of like a U in our state, and our state sits as a rectangle. But I did notice that the first time I had kind of gotten calls about it, I think was 2011. We had a hurricane that just kind of pushed straight up through the eastern seaboard and like directly through the middle of our state, which is odd because usually the jet stream pushes everything off further to the east. But like I think we got like 13 inches of rain in the day here at like at my place. And like I'm in the mountains, so if you take a mountain and you flatten it out, there's a lot of surface area, and it filled all the valleys. Like the rivers were like 20 foot high, and like it was taking out roads and covering bridges that if you stood on today and I said they were covered with water, you'd call me a liar. Like it was insane. But we got a lot of EHD, relatively
Yeah,
speaking. I mean, there was
hurricanes.
250 some cases or something in the state, which was a lot. And is that like, does the Midge just kind of ride those weather patterns up? How does that work?
Yeah, so hurricanes have definitely been linked to getting those midges further north than they usually are seen. I think just a couple of years ago, New York kind of had a big EHD year, and it correlated with hurricanes that had come up the coast. Even Florida will get other serotypes of EHD or like foreign hemorrhagic viruses from other countries when hurricanes bring it in. So Florida's kind of a mixing pot of craziness down there, but primarily it's still just EHDV1, 2, and 6. But yeah, weather is certainly connected, and wet years tend to make the cases more spread out. Dry years are actually more linked to higher incidence rates of EHD because, well, what they believe is there's less watering holes for animals to go to, so they congregate. And when those watering holes are lower, then the mud that the midge eggs are laid in, and then the, I don't know what they would be called, I'm not an entomologist, but the new midges like that mud and like enriched soil on the edges of water. So dry seasons, definitely higher prevalence of EHD. Because all those deer come to the same spot, and then it's more easily transmissible. Deer-to-deer contact is not how EHD is spread. They have to be bitten by the midge to get the disease.
When you look at, I kind of want to hone in on some of our historical knowledge of what we know about EHD, which you've talked about a little bit. And then I want to hop back to the kind of symptomatic issues that deer express. My understanding is a lot of work was done in Florida. I mean, I don't I look at Florida and like, it's like 2 feet above the sea, right? So like there's water everywhere. You think about like the Everglades and like it's tropical. You know what I mean? Like it's tropical. You guys have Medgene has worked with the Sherry lab down there. Do you want to talk a little bit about kind of how and when that started and how that relationship has developed over the years and some of the work they've done? Because I know it was pretty extensive.
So we actually met Dr. Samantha Wisely and Dr. Juan Campos at a NADIFA event 2017, 2018, somewhere around there. And they have done studies with other vaccines that contained EHD and found that the vaccines were not effective. So what they would do is take farms, give them vaccine. Some of the animals wouldn't get vaccine, and then they would be drawing blood samples, doing PCR for all the EHD strains, all the blue tongue strains, doing necropsy for any animal that dies during summer months, basically. And then at the end, they could make a conclusion of the unvaccinated and vaccinated animals. So yeah, when they originally did that with other previous options for EHD vaccines, they concluded that the vaccine did nothing to help reduce or prevent EHD. So when Dr. Samantha Wisely found out about Medgene, either myself or Dr. Alan Young, the founder of Medgene, would have presented at NADIFA. And she approached us and was interested in testing our vaccine in Florida farms. So we got that study rolling. We provided vaccines to Florida farms. The CHERRY team, so Servidae Health and Research Initiative, from the University of Florida, they did all of the work. So they helped the farms vaccinate, collect blood samples, do all of the things, necropsies. Florida actually has a program where they can provide free diagnostics to dairy farmers. So if you're in Florida, that's a great thing to know. So reach out to them. And at the end of the study, they found that the prevalence and mortality rates from EHD with our vaccinated animals was reduced compared to unvaccinated. I believe there were zero EHD deaths in, well, EHDV2. It was just EHDV2 vaccine at the time. There were zero EHDV2 deaths in the vaccinated animals compared to, I would have to look up those numbers, but we have that available. But there were EHDV2 deaths in unvaccinated animals. And CHERRY put out a publication saying Medgene's vaccine reduces the risk of illness and death from EHDV2 at the time. We have six in there now. But and then they went on to do an evaluation with the EHDV2 and 6 vaccine, approve that yes, it does work against EHDV2 and 6 now. So from an outside company or research group looking at our vaccine under the same eyes that they did with a different vaccine and concluded that didn't work. I think that's a good opportunity for deer farmers to say, yes, a research group that is trying to optimize health for deer farmers in Florida, but hopefully across the US, taking that knowledge, does support the use of Medgene's EHDV2 and 6 vaccine
Yeah,
through scientific data.
that's no, that's good news. They also and I've they put out a newsletter, so you can anybody can it's a free newsletter. Just I don't know what the website is, but it's like sherrylab.com or something like that. I'll link it in the show notes. I'll find it. Sign up for that newsletter if you're in EHD country, because they are consistently updating what's there. But I know they did a lot of, I think they did. I've seen some of the pictures of the grad students and you know, postdoctorate candidates and whatever, collecting bugs, right? So they like had
Yes.
these cool bug traps, and they're like catching them on deer and whatever they're doing, and they're like drawing blood and running DNA analysis and piping the bugs out, whatever they're doing. Can you talk a
Yeah,
little bit about that?
so they've been able to look into the different midge species to see which ones are more likely to transmit EHD versus blue tongue. And they have found that there are different species that tend to transmit blue tongue versus EHD. And I believe this year they're even starting research studies to determine how to better use the misting systems and whatnot to kill midges, because different midge species lay their eggs in different environments. How those eggs grow, they might be at different levels in the soil and stuff like that. So I know that's upcoming research that they're doing. So it's not just vaccines that they're looking at. They look at a lot of different things and how they can advance science to help deer farms. But yeah, they do a lot of work. They will come to farms with the little traps, see what kind of midges are on your property. They will help design management solutions for the property, you know, trying to get rid of standing water, stuff like that. So,
and I want to say just, there's certainly a never ending stream of people that have to deal with EHD on a regular basis. So let's just start with that. Many of the listeners to the show who are, you know, kind of in the private deer space, they have to deal with EHD, and there's all sorts of different kind of ecoregions to the country. But when you look at, and I want to say that that lab took on this initiative, 2014 or 15 or something like that. And they got a round of funding, and they got another round of funding. So they've been at this for a decade, and all of this information, in all the things they do, whether we can see the value in that or not, the results that they provide back to us and the data on all these separate kind of entities that they're working through is really helpful to us. What we do with that is a separate conversation. Of course, Medgene's taken a lead role on that with the vaccines, which we're going to get into in a second. But the management's another part of that. And I think everybody, at least the people that I've talked to, you know, everybody's got their own ideas of how to mess with EHD, and I'm not going to get into the specifics, but it seems like an all of the above kind of approach, right? Where,
yes,
you know, you can't, let's be clear, there's not a magic shot. There's nothing that
exactly.
You can feed them. Like, you can't just miss, but you can do a variety of things. And yeah. And the fact that we have those tools and that lab is able to provide those resources is a great thing. So take advantage of that, read up on it, and we can all learn a bunch from that. So that's good news. I want to jump back to the kind of symptomatic properties of EHD and how it affects deer. So could you just describe, you know, like, let's just say I'm in one of the kind of southern states, let's say Louisiana, right? I want to be a Cajun. Let's be clear. I want access to crawfish. I want oysters on a regular basis. And my buddy Josh Kaplan over there keeps telling about this. He tells me about this jambalaya like every third time I talk to him. He's got this jambalaya recipe that'll knock my socks off. So I'm going to try to get down to the Louisiana event this year. If you're listening from Louisiana, don't hold me to that, but I certainly am going to try because I want to go put a hurting on some crawdads. But anyway, so I'm in Louisiana, right? There's EHD prevalence every year for a good chunk of the year because they have the weather for it and where they're kind of strategically located in the US. What are some of the symptoms that that you've seen and producers have kind of reported back when it comes to EHD? What does that look like? What do these animals kind of experience?
Yeah, so I think the generalized symptoms would be lethargy, fever, you know, just general, obviously not feeling good. But then the high tail signs of a hemorrhagic disease would be swelling of the neck, the tongue a lot of times will be blue. And that's, I think, a lot of reason why people get confused and just call EHD blue tongue because of the symptoms. Again, they are two different viruses, but they display the exact same clinical signs. I've had people report bulging eyes to the point of like eyes coming out of the socket. And then obviously in the end stages, it will be hemorrhaging. So honestly, hemorrhaging from any orifice that is there. Sometimes there are really no signs. You'll go out, check your animals. Everybody looks good. 12 hours later, you have dead deer. Diagnostic testing is the most important thing to remember when dealing with any hemorrhagic disease, because you can't tell the difference between EHD and blue tongue. You certainly cannot tell the difference between EHDV1, EHDV2, EHDV6. So very important to try to get that testing done. Medgene can help with any of that. We can help you understand what samples are needed by a diagnostic lab, get you in contact with the closest diagnostic lab or one that we recommend that we work with. We help cover some of the costs of that testing, especially if you're, well, if you're using our vaccine, we definitely do. But because what we want to know, is it EHDV2 or 6? Because that's what our vaccine is supposed to cover. If they are dying of EHDV2 or 6, can we get a sequence from those viruses to understand, has there been a mutation that would maybe lead to our vaccine not working as well as it should be? Now, not saying our vaccine is 100% effective. No vaccine is. But we definitely have seen across the board of users of our vaccine, the incidence rate of EHD deaths from when they never use the vaccine to now when they use it, they definitely have less animals dying. Some farms will do like half herd vaccination, and they have definitely seen a major difference in those unvaccinated animals. Some people report, you know, they'll still get a little sick, but they're able to help them recover with supportive care and stuff like that. So the vaccine from users is working as a tool in the toolbox. Like you said, this is not something you should just vaccinate and forget about everything else. I do recommend that you still, you know, make sure your pens don't have standing water, like management practices of your facilities, and then misting and all of the tools. Use everything you can to help prevent it, because it is a serious issue that can lead to almost entire herd loss.
Yeah.
A couple of years ago, when EHD went further north than it ever has, North Dakota, there were farms that lost 90% of their herd. I mean, they were almost out of business. So
I'm not, I don't know if you know this or not, so I'm going to ask it. And if not, we'll move on. Why is it that someone can walk out, look at their animals in the morning, and then they come back and the animals are dead? Like how is that virus just moving through the body so fast and causing this kind of cataclysmic event inside of them that just turns their insides out and just makes them die? Like how does that happen? Why does it happen so fast?
Because
most disease just takes time, right? Like animal gets sick and like it might be sick for a week or two, right? And you do some supportive care and that helps with,
yeah,
you know, maybe secondary infection or whatever that is, or maybe it's a bacteria you're dealing with and it has treatment capabilities. But like, what is it about EHD that is, why is it so virulent?
Right. So first off, we have to think about deer being prey animals, and they don't want to look sick, right? So that can be part of the whole thing, is that they are trying their best not to act like they're feeling bad. So I think that comes into play. And then the second thing, hemorrhagic diseases in general just seem to be very, you're fine. 6 to 12 hours later, you're not and you're dead. Medgene also has a rabbit hemorrhagic disease vaccine. It is a different virus family. But it's still a hemorrhagic disease. And the same thing happens in rabbits. Mm. They will be fine. 6 to 12 hours later, you have dead rabbits. Mm. And yeah, sometimes signs don't even happen. It just happens that fast. But the viruses target major organs. So like when you need to do a necropsy on a deer that you believe you lost from EHD or blue tongue, the liver is what we need. And that's where that virus is concentrated. And so the target of those major organs also has to do with the quickness of the mortality.
Yeah. I haven't experienced it. I don't want to experience it. But I couldn't imagine just, you know, going out and feeding in the morning or cleaning water and looking up and, you know, you got a couple does standing there and maybe there's a couple fawns too, depending on the time of year. And, you know, you come back out and they're just laying there and they're, you know, they got blood spewing out of their nose, their eyeballs blown out. And, it's just, that's a mess. So, tell me about cattle as a vector.
Yeah. So definitely more than just cattle, but yes, okay. Cattle
add some species.
Yeah. So we know mule deer can carry it and typically don't display too many clinical signs, although there is a research article that correlates low reproductive rates and mule deer staying in velvet longer with a high EHD prevalent year. And I think probably for a lot of species, this comes into play with reproductive performance. Elk can be carriers, reindeer, cattle, yes. But we just don't know what other species might be carrying it. Anything that those midges would feed on is probably something to look into. But cattle, so they can be carriers and for the most part not get sick from it. But what that means is if you have cattle along with your deer or a farm, ranch, whatever, a mile away, and all of those cattle are little feeders for the midges, and transmitting and transmitting and transmitting, the EHD prevalence in that area is going to be higher because there's a lot more animals infected, even though they're not sick. So the likelihood of a midge to feed on one, have that virus, and then come and feed on your deer is a lot higher. But I think EHD is a lot bigger problem in cattle than they realize or want to admit. Again, linking that to reproductive issues. Some people have actually asked the question and have realized, yes, EHD is a problem. We have gotten questions about using our EHD vaccine in cattle. The USDA has not approved that, but it's just something we would have to work with if there is a cattle ranch that actually wants to move forward with that. For them, I think it comes down to kind of cost. It's a little less cost effective in the cattle industry than for deer. So
kind of sparked something in my head. Angus cattle have kind of dominated the breed species, if you will, in the US, call it over the past, you know, 50 years, probably a little longer, but 50 years. And I'm not discounting any, all you cattle guys listening. I'm not picking on you for not having Angus and your Herefords may be doing fine or whatever you have. I'm not saying that, but like, I do wonder if, there are certain species that have, the ability to, or certain breeds of cattle that have the ability to, you know, withstand the disease for whatever reason. Maybe they have longer hair, maybe they have thicker hides. You know, I know there's some African breeds of cattle that are like armored, right? And you know, I wonder if we've done a poor job as a I don't breed cows, so I'm talking out the window right now, but like I wonder if we've done a poor job at looking at some of these kind of non BRD diseases and ignored them for whatever reason, and just kind of focused on this profit chain that we've established in the US beef industry. I do wonder if crossbreeding would be valuable. It probably would be for a whole host of reasons. But I'm going to jump back to deer and point to something that you had mentioned, and that was a few years ago, EHD pushing further north into, you had mentioned North Dakota, which is like, that's up by Canada, guys. Like, if you're not familiar with the US map, that's about as far north as it goes. That's from lack of exposure, I assume. That's from just a naive immune system never being in contact with EHD.
Yes, correct.
So,
Interesting, just to comment on that. At the Florida event this year, I talked to a farm that they're apparently on the coast and have, I think, mostly like sandy soil or something like that. And they don't get EHD. But when people buy deer from them and transport them to their farms, they will die from EHD. So for whatever reason, that farm in Florida, like the prime location for hemorrhagic diseases, they don't get it where they are. But they're like a mile, or like they can see the ocean from their house, is what I was told.
Oh, a
So
deer
it
farm by an
is
ocean.
totally
Tough
like
life.
area. I know. Geography has a lot to do with it too.
That's
So,
interesting. So if and I don't know this, but I've heard people say this. I know Dr. Seabury has commented on it, that he believes there's some sort of genetic component. Whether that's true or not, we don't know, right? And obviously more work needs to be done on that. Do you have some thoughts on it? Do you think it's just an exposure thing as the disease moves into areas that haven't been affected before? And do you think that there's maybe an acclimation, that's probably not the right word, but an acclimation process in the South, or a consistent exposure to the disease year over year, generation over generation, that aids in supporting life for those specific regions of the country, let's say like a South Texas or something like that.
I think there's two things in play. Genetic wise, I don't, it's hard for me to buy into genetic resistance against a virus, but I definitely know that genetics has everything to do with how sturdy and robust your immune system is. So, are there certain genetic lines that are more robust health-wise in general? Certainly. So I
Gotcha.
think that does come into play, as far as genetics specifically against EHD virus. I'd have to see a lot more science for
Yeah, sure. No,
that
that makes perfect
to
sense. And
see.
I didn't even put those kind of two things together, right? Like, so there's certainly animals that are more sound. There's just no doubt.
Yeah,
And
exactly. Just like people, like some people always seem to be sick, and then there's other people that just are like never sick. And
right.
that's just like you have a better immune system in general, and genetics definitely can come into play with how well your immune system works. And then as far as exposure, yes. So locations that have consistent natural exposure will build up natural immunity. But I can count on more than one hand how many Texas farms have said that they don't need EHD vaccine because they have resistant deer. And then we get a call in August or September when they're having EHD outbreaks. So natural exposure is not the end all be all. I mean, it certainly does help. as long as the exposure is consistent and doesn't kill them when the first exposure happens, right? So
yeah, and
vaccination is a tool in the toolbox.
Yep.
And you can use many different things and you don't have to vaccinate, but I think it's a good tool to think about using, obviously.
Yeah, no, I agree. And that was the point I was going to make. It's the all above approach, right? And exposure certainly helps, you know, like, and I think you mentioned the word consistent, right? Because like you can get exposed and then, you know, that immunity dies off in a generation. So consistent exposure. And I suspect there are, you know, like I mentioned Louisiana, like I know guys, they deal with EHD every year. Like that's just part of life. And I suspect there's many such geographical places that do. And that's probably why Florida was a great place to do that study, because they find EHD in January, right? Like that happens.
Exactly.
So for all you folks that think you're safe in the winter, you're not. have your management items in order. Okay. So I want to get into MedGene as a company a little bit. Can you just kind of give us a background of what MedGene is, kind of how it was established, and then we'll work through some items from there.
Yeah. So MedGene was founded in 2011 by Dr. Alan Young, a professor from South Dakota State University, and MedGene spun off of technology that he started at SDSU. It was not a vaccine company. Actually, we were working on scrapie in sheep, trying to develop an assay to test for scrapie without needing a dead animal, basically. So that's where we started. But to keep MedGene going, Alan was also looking at other research partnerships with other universities to get grants, just to fund research in general. And one of those ended up being a partnership with Kansas State University to do some research for a Rift Valley fever vaccine. So that's where our vaccine history started.
What's Rift Valley
with Kansas
vaccine?
State. Yeah, Rift Valley fever is a virus in Africa, but it poses a really big threat to the U.S. as far as a foreign animal disease. It infects sheep, and it can also infect humans. So the USDA wants stockpiles of vaccine against Rift Valley fever in the event that we would get Rift Valley fever here, because it would decimate sheep populations and then pose a public health threat. So we were working on that with Kansas State. Currently, our Rift Valley fever vaccine has reasonable expectation of efficacy approved through the USDA. So we haven't done all of the parts, also because it's a foreign animal disease, you have to have like the highest level biosecurity and whatnot. So we're working on some of that with the new lab that is opening in Kansas and BAF. So we'll continue our RIFT studies there. So that's been a very long research, and that's usually how vaccines go. 10 years is not a ridiculous amount of time to get a vaccine from when you first start researching to actually commercialization. Then because of Rift Valley fever, we were also working on a grant to try to make an oral option, because you need to think about wildlife and how you can get those vaccines out to wildlife. So we put in a proposal for a research study to look at Rift Valley fever, oral vaccination, and EHD. So going back to Dr. Alan Young and his prion research, not only involved scrapie, but also CWD, and he knew Sean Schaefer. And because of that connection with the CWD and Sean and Nadifa, Sean brought up EHD. And could we find a solution to that or a tool for the toolbox for that? So Alan looked into EHD. There's actually a lot of research into EHD. We know the targets for an effective vaccine. Kansas State actually was also working on that. So we started with Kansas State a little bit, getting that going. And then with the grant for oral vaccines, we added in trying an oral vaccine in white-tailed deer. So that was in 2015 when we got that funded. And our first deer studies were in 2016. We did injectable along with oral vaccination. Injectable is effective, whereas oral vaccination, not great. You can kind of get it to work, but also trying to license an oral vaccine through the USDA, not a very feasible process. So we dropped off the oral component and just started going after the injectable EHD vaccine that we have now. With all of that going on, we had an outside company ask us about making swine influenza vaccine for them. Actually just the antigen part, and then we would send the antigen and they would manufacture the vaccine themselves. So we used
our H1N1 or something.
H3, I believe, is what we ended up licensing.
Excellent.
Yeah. So our overall vaccine technology is the same no matter what target we're looking at this point. We are a killed baculovirus vector system. So what that means is we use a baculovirus, which is an insect cell virus, and we use microbiology to insert what we call a plasmid into that baculovirus, and then it makes whatever protein we put in there. So for EHD, we put a VP2, it's a protein on the EHD virus, and a second virus, baculovirus, with a VP5. So VP2 and VP5 in a baculovirus. When you use that baculovirus to infect insect cells, those insect cells then create a bunch of the protein that you want. So our vaccines are just protein and they're adjuvanted. We don't need an actual virus to make our vaccines. We need a sequence, a genetic sequence, to the proteins that are important for the vaccine to work.
Okay. Before we go further, I want to go back to the cell lines that you're working with, just so people can understand the technical process of how this all works. So you have a baculovirus, right? Let's just, I'm going to use my hand, so I hope you're watching. We have this virus strain, right? And it sits here. It's like a base strain. This is the strain that you guys work from for the entire technology. Is that right?
Yeah. So it's actually the virus, and then we have to do things to
surface.
Let it come in and then.
Okay. So you don't like my stage I was building from. So
it's not linear.
Well, in my mind,
part of the
linear.
Process it is. Like, you gotta get it. It has to open to let the insert in,
but you're attaching things to that, right?
Yes.
And then they're becoming.
We're modifying the original baculovirus. Yes.
Okay. And when you do that, it creates proteins.
Once we use that modified baculovirus to infect an insect cell, that insect cell creates the proteins.
And then the proteins,
like, mass spits
the proteins
out.
Are then used.
Yes.
That's what we're getting.
In the vaccine. Yes.
So we're getting protein. That and an adjuvant, which is a vehicle for transfer in the body, if you will.
Yes. And an adjuvant also stimulates a generalized immune response.
Perfect.
So it basically tells your body, you need to start responding to this thing. Without an adjuvant, our vaccines would not work because just injecting yourself with protein doesn't really do anything unless you're like allergic to peanuts, then that could kill you if you, you know, so, sure. But just injecting like VP2 protein from EHD, that's not going to elicit any sort of immune response.
Okay. I didn't mean to cut in, but thank you. Okay.
No, it's all good information.
Okay. So we have this technology, we have this vaccine. What do we do with it?
Yeah. So to get a vaccine license, is that where you want me to go?
Like, sure, we can do that,
or wherever I want to go.
Yeah.
Or what do you do with the vaccine into your animals?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. And yes.
Yes. So our vaccine, 2 doses when you first use it. It's labeled for intramuscular injection, but our original studies for probably the first 2 or 3 years were all subcutaneous, so just under the skin, not in a muscle. When we got more interconnected to the deer industry and realized the use of dart guns, we tried to add like intramuscular on the label to do like sub-Q or intramuscular. The USDA didn't want that, so we had to choose one or the other. So we just put intramuscular, and all of our data, whether subcutaneous injection or intramuscular, it's all the same. Like, you, there would be no statistical difference between the data that we've seen from both routes. So I would say just get it into the animal, although not into a vein.
That ID in deer.
Yeah, there you go.
that's what farmers do. There's nuance, right? Like,
yeah,
between sub Q and IM, but I've heard that kind of mildly inflammatory joke before in the deer. Yeah, got it.
Yeah. So those doses on the label, 3 weeks apart. Now that's a pretty standard protocol for a 2-dose vaccine. And we just have to pick something that we basically always use in our research studies, because our label claim has to be backed up by scientific data so that the USDA approves the label claim. But in general, immunology 101, when you first give a vaccine, that first dose needs about 2 weeks for your immune response to do the process it needs to do to respond. So anytime after those 2 weeks, you could give a second dose, but not before 2 weeks. You need 2 weeks between the doses before you start your second dose. And you can go out to 6, 8. You do eventually get to a point where your immune system will forget that first dose if you don't get that second dose in. But also keep in mind, the vaccine doesn't work until you get that initial second dose in. So you don't want to prolong it too long. And then every year, just a single dose booster is what we recommend for basically mid US and North. Southern states, depending on how common cases are popping up in like January and stuff, perhaps every 6 months is not a bad idea. But farms can make that decision, because I know like financials come into play and working animals and trying to do all of those things. But definitely a dose in the spring, before 3 weeks before fawning, is the absolute last time you'd want to vaccinate pregnant does, at least. Mm-hmm. We do have data to support maternal antibody transfer to those fawns. And then those fawns have those maternal antibodies for about 4 months before maternal antibodies just go away in general. And then at that point, you would want to vaccinate your fawns probably about 3 months so that they're not lacking any coverage.
Gotcha.
What we don't know is if fawns are coming from fully vaccinated does, Is there vaccine interference if you vaccinate those fawns really young? We don't really know that yet. What we have seen in one study, so this is an N of one, and scientifically you don't like to make judgments on that, but in the one study that we did in 2 week old fawns, there was maternal antibody transfer from naturally exposed animals. This was a study in Missouri. So yeah, they have EHD. So those fawns did not, there was a couple fawns that did not start EHD negative at that 2 week of age. So they got maternal antibodies from their moms, but we still saw a vaccine response. So in one study, it appears there was no maternal antibody interference. But again, it wasn't very many animals to make a conclusion from. So
right. Okay. So if we have someone that, you know, has some animals dying, they think it's EHD, what do they do? They're interested in getting some vaccine. What do they do, diagnostics, and how does that work?
Sure. So vaccines are preventative medicine, not treatments. So that's a big thing to keep in mind.
Sure.
You would want to vaccinate ahead of any impending outbreaks, right? Mm-hmm. If you are having an outbreak and call and want vaccine, we are going to recommend you don't vaccinate at that time. Vaccinating sick animals is not helpful to anyone involved. The vaccine isn't going to be effective. And then you're just stressing those animals out more when they're already fighting a disease. So we need to be thinking ahead and preventing the disease from running its course, basically. But if you do end up in a situation where you have an outbreak, you think it's some sort of hemorrhagic disease, EHD, blue tongue, whatever. If you already have a diagnostic lab that you work with, what you want to do is get a sample of, did I say liver before? I think I did.
Yes.
It's spleen. Yep. a sample of spleen to the diagnostic lab. Cherry actually has a very nice necropsy video and shows you like where to find the spleen and how to take a sample to send it to a diagnostic lab. So Josh, if you need that, I can send you that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
Link or whatever.
Yep.
So overnight on ice packs, keep it cold. You don't want it to get warm. That will destroy the virus and we won't get any good information. Yeah, you can freeze it. It'll be fine. We can, so it's PCR that they use. That's fine to freeze it.
Explain just real before we go on, just what's a PCR?
PCR is polymerase chain reaction. That's what it stands for. So at diagnostic labs, they have machines that are capable of identifying viruses, and what they do is go through a program that will amplify a virus if it's there. So when you see a PCR result, it'll say CT and then a number. So a CT of 21. So that means a cycle threshold of 21. So it had to cycle 21 times before they identified that virus. So that's what those numbers mean. So actually the higher that number, the less virus is present. So if you have a low CT value, that means there's high virus. And that would be good for trying to get a sequence from that virus. We can also look at metagenomic sequencing. So that will, again, molecular biology and whatnot, go through a process of trying to amplify and identify any virus that is potentially in that sample, not just like EHD or blue tongue specific. So a couple of years ago, we did that for a farm in Missouri, and we found Tularia, which is a disease spread by ticks. And it said it was very highly prevalent in the sample. And I believe that sample was like negative for EHD. So it was a very strange case that happened. But that also helps us identify what other diseases could be affecting the deer that we don't necessarily think about or know about. And of course, Medgene's here to help with all of that, get you in contact with labs if you don't have a diagnostic lab to work with, help cover some of those costs if you're using our vaccines, make sure all the correct testing gets done, stuff like that.
Okay, so I got my spleen over to the diagnostic lab. I've already talked to you. What's next? I got the PCR back. It's positive. I got a good CT count. What do we do?
Yep. Okay. So from there, we would request sequencing to try to get a sequence
What is that?
of.
Tell us what that is.
So that's the genetic makeup of the virus.
Okay.
And then if we can do sequencing and it's successful, then Medgene can compare the VP2 and VP5 regions of the virus to what we have in the vaccine and determine if there was any mutations. If it should have been effective, then we look into did we vaccinate at the right time? Like we'll look into vaccination protocol and stuff like that. But
Let's
again, vaccination isn't 100%
sure.
effective, so sometimes it'll just
Well, let's just stick
happen.
on the person that hasn't vaccinated yet, right?
Sure. Yeah.
Okay, so they sequence the virus. Thumbs up, good, right? You guys do your comparison for your VP2, VP5 proteins, and then what? Then what do you do? What's that call to that producer sound like?
So if it's a mass, so if they have EHDV2 confirmed on their farm, we would highly recommend that following year, that fall, to get the two doses on board for their herd.
Okay.
Because we believe then they would have fewer incidents of mortality from EHDV2
Okay, let's
the
say the
future.
sequencing comes back, you make the comparison, and there is a mutation. What then?
Yeah, so that would be cool because we haven't seen
I
that
knew
yet.
you'd like that. Anybody that works in
So let's
science
say
likes this stuff.
it's a new serotype of EHD that we've never identified.
Yep.
Medgene will create a whole new set of constructs, so VP2 and VP5 to that serotype. So what that looks like is making those baculovirus. So putting the new VP2 into a baculovirus, then it's called a construct. So if I ever say that word, that's what that means is that newly designed baculovirus with the new target in it. So a VP2 construct, a VP5 construct, and then go through the USDA approval process to get those master seeds. Approved for use in our production facility. So the USDA requires specific testing to ensure that your master seeds are free of exogenous agents. So you don't want any other viral contaminants. There was a recent company that had a parvovirus in their master seeds, stuff like that can happen if things aren't tested properly. So that's part of the master seed testing, and then ensuring there's no mycoplasma and then no other bacterial or fungal
And
contaminants.
these are
So
all
then
just,
they become a
sorry, they're all quality. This is a quality assurance process. So you're not
correct.
inadvertently introducing something else from this vaccine into these animals.
Yes,
Okay,
correct.
gotcha.
So once they're approved for use in our production facility, then we can start making antigen, so the VP2 and VP5 proteins. Once that's done, our EHD vaccine is a little more labor intensive than our swine and cattle vaccines and rabbit. We actually purify the protein. So when we make those constructs, so the VP2 construct for EHD, we actually add on six histidines, so it's called a histag, That allows us to be able to identify the protein in a Western blot and other things, but it also allows us to purify it. So out of the insect cell culture that the protein is being made in our swine vaccines, what we do is just crush all of that up, concentrate it, and then it goes into, well, it gets killed, the baculovirus is killed, and then goes into a bottle at whatever concentration we need for that specific vaccine. For EHD, we crush everything up to release the proteins, and then we put it through a system that will bind the HIS tag from like the VP2 protein to a column. So all we're taking is the protein. So it's pure protein, and all the cell debris and other stuff is excreted. And then we just use the pure protein in the EHD vaccine. So that's how it differs from our swine and cattle and rabbit vaccines. What would be amazing for us is to get the EHD vaccine to work without having to do that purification step, because we could then put it under our prescription license instead of having it the way it is right now. But we have never been able to get the vaccine to work when we manufacture it without purifying it. And we do study, we've done studies every single year, sometimes a couple studies a year, trying to figure out the mechanisms behind why it's not working. It's more than just like pure protein versus not pure protein. We also use a different chemical for inactivation between our swine vaccine and the EHD vaccine. There's a different adjuvant, though we've tested, and that doesn't appear to actually be the key to it working or not. So we've kind of eliminated that. So there are a few components of the manufacturing process that we're trying to narrow in on and see which is actually causing the issue. But for the last 3-4 years, we haven't been able to narrow down exactly what's going on with that protein that makes it not effective when we don't purify it. And actually, that's one of the studies going on right now at a farm in Missouri, Oak Creek Whitetail Ranch. Actually just vaccinated with the second dose today. Blood samples going to be sent over to us by the end of the week. What we did was we took one of our swine vaccines, manufactured according to how our license states, so not purified, inactivated with a different chemical, and then a different adjuvant than our EHD vaccine. And we know that we get a serological response with that swine influenza vaccine in swine. So we're gonna see, do we get an immune response in deer to that swine influenza vaccine?
Right.
Because if we do, that would point to something with actual EHD proteins that is being screwed up when it's not purified, if that makes sense.
It does.
Yeah.
I want to make a comment for the listeners. You can see the level of technical ability that Medgene has to put into these products, and how thoughtful that this has been put together. So kudos to you guys for, you know, taking the time and resources and efforts to put this together for people to use. I have one kind of final question before we wrap up. Somebody wants some EHD vaccine, and I know we're late in the season, but you know, people could be listening to this any time of year. How do I get EHD vaccine from you? So I give you a call. Yeah. I'm like, hey, I need EHD vaccine. How long does that take?
So if your state has already approved it, then it's just a matter of getting the USDA to approve a certain number of doses to be shipped to your farm, which their turnaround time lately has been a couple days. So if you're in a state that gave us blanket approval for distribution from the time that you get us all the information we need to submit the order to the time that we can ship it, a couple days.
Gotcha. If people want,
and actually to note, if you don't get everything vaccinated before 3 weeks before fawning, you, as long as you have animals fully vaccinated before August, even July, maybe nowadays we're seeing it a little bit sooner than August, but basically before August, that's fine. So you can wait until July to vaccinate if you'd rather do that. I know most people don't want to be doing that, but
yeah, it's not super fun. It can be, right, number one, tough to handle animals. But certainly, you know, using remote delivery is an option. Maybe for a 1,000 head operation, that's not something they want to take on, but certainly there's countless number of farms that have, you know, sub 20 head breeding doe operations that not a big deal, and can also do their bucks that way. So no, that's good. That's good insight. If people want more information on MedGene, I'm going to link the MedGene site down there. And if it's okay, I'll put your email in the show notes, and people can get a hold of you that way.
Yep.
Any closing thoughts on EHD?
I think a big point, you don't have a problem until you do. I know a lot of farms say, well, I don't, you, Josh.
Oh, here we go.
I don't have EHD.
Here we go.
Well, you don't until you do. I mean, I hope you never have to experience it, but just keep that in mind, because, you know, those North Dakota farms that I knew the people from the farms before they ever used the vaccine. And they were always, you know, for a couple of years, they were like, we don't get EHD way up here. And then when I saw on Facebook that they were losing, I mean, they had a skid loader taking all the deer out of the pens.
Yep.
Like, that's how tragic it was.
Yep.
And knowing that, you know, they didn't have a problem until they did. And now they vaccinate.
But plan ahead. Get some vaccine. Get your animals vaccinated. Like I said, I'll link up your info there, and anybody wants some further info, they can give you a call. I really appreciate you coming on today, and maybe we'll do another one, and we'll mention some other animal diseases. I didn't want to say it because I haven't talked about it in on the show anyway, but I didn't say the word CWD. I just said it, so my streak is intact, because I think I've said CWD on every show for like 50 shows straight. But maybe we'll talk some influenza and stuff in the future here. So thank you for coming on. Yeah. I appreciate it.
Yeah. Thanks for having me, Josh.
As always, stay tuned for another episode of North American Deer Talk.